This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Thank you all for waiting. I'm very happy you could join us for tonight's launch of a book that actually has been available for a little while. And in fact, the only copies available of the book in the United States are over there. There are about 30 or 40 of them left. And I'm very happy that amongst you here is Lex Troy, who's the co-publisher of the book, who's come all the way from Switzerland for the New York Art Book Fair, presumably.
No, or to be here tonight.
To be here tonight. That is even better. And the story of how this article in Cabinet in 2002 became this book via Lex is, I think, part of what you'll be telling us about tonight as well.
A little bit, yeah.
Enjoy. I think you're going to do a talk, 15, 20 minutes about the book. And then we'll have a Q&A after that. And
I'll show a few images, and then I'll read a little section of the book. So the book is a memoir of some pretty remarkable adventures I had while doing research. And those of you who've read the Cabinet article know that the point of departure for the book is a Swiss photographer named Ernst Morey, who was the person after whom the Morey effect is named, which is what happens when two dot matrices become misaligned in printing and you get a blurry image. And I went to Switzerland initially to research him, and had this quite strange experience of working there, and discovered, you know, gradually that he was somebody who had just narrowly missed making all of these technological contributions to the history of photography, which was his lifelong goal. Wet collodion, he had a gelatin silver bromide solution to get over that problem, autochrome, flash bulbs, but none of them we know him for. He didn't ever quite get credit for any of these. Through various circumstances, his contributions either weren't recognized under Canton law, they were classified as crafts rather than as arts, or he didn't sign the patent forms correctly. And so unfortunately, what happened is he sort of became extremely broke and was forced to accept a mundane commission documenting Alpine architecture. His uncle Jürg was a Canton architecture commissioner, and along with his friend Willy, he documented all this Alpine architecture. And right at the moment that Willy was about to publish the final version, they're making a book also for the government. Lex got the Morey got the. Sorry about that. Maybe that could go down a tiny bit. See that. Got the invention bug and went up to the Matterhorn to try to pioneer flashbulb-based night photography. And he had an improvised early version of the flash, and he misread his dials and blinded his wife. And while he was nursing her back to health, the commission came due. Billy misprinted the plates, and he blamed it on Amore again. And he became known for this. And so, you know, it's this kind of tragic situation, and the final twist of it was that the Swiss government came in and actually physically Morey'd him out of all the photographs that existed of him. So it made following his trail extremely difficult, actually, because there's not a single good photograph of him that's non-Morey'd. So that's what I knew in 2002. And in 2010, a package arrived that essentially reopened the case for me in ways I'll describe a little bit in what follows. But to kind of set the mood and the atmosphere for it, I thought I would just show you a few images for first. The one we've been looking at is in the book. It's Walter Mittelholzer, who's the founder of what will become Swissair and a pioneer of aerial photography. He plays a role later on. We'll see him. Sina, can I have the next one? These are some of the sort of anti-gravitational photographs that Moret was interested in. I'll talk more about how he became curious about the particular qualities of Swiss Alpine modernism. The next one actually is a more dynamic shot that gets at this. The Swiss, one of the writers I refer, what we'll talk about thinks of as a kind of conflict that the Swiss have with gravity. Next one. So this is it's a kind of soup landscape, and it's something that you encounter frequently in Switzerland. They're so interested in Norse soup that even in very small convenience stores, they make this kind of reassuring green soup landscape that you can basically find anywhere. Even if they have like 12 square feet, 7 of them will be devoted to this kind of situation. And I think, can I have the next one? I think it actually informs a certain, this is Vaudeville, and it's a early suburban tract, and it looks almost edible. This is actually a photograph that's taken from, in a book published by Swiss Air. And what's so stunning about this to me is not just that it realized the kind of latent possibilities of the Noor soup landscape, but that it also made the project of suburbanization almost attractive. Can I have the next one? And then these are the kind of two extremes of the project of Swiss modernization. This one appears in the book. This is by the Worley brothers. And it's a view that was on exhibit when I was there. And I take this to be kind of a programmatic shot of Swiss modernization in the sense of the project of instrumentalizing landscape. And you have a train rushing across a beautifully constructed alpine bridge. You have a road snaking underneath that train bridge. Several other bridges in the distance, and roads visible up the hillside. The only thing that the Swiss haven't done is to produce a kind of vertical lock system yet on the water, and it seems like that's kind of the next phase that needs to be developed here. But so, next one, Sina, please. This is sort of the other side of Swiss modernization, and this is a guy named Rudolf Zingler-Danioff, and this photograph is all the way back from the 1860s, and I also saw it when I was in Switzerland. And I'm fascinated because, as far as I can tell, there's not a lot of information available on this photographer, but I think he may have been a kind of specialist in corroded roadsides and kind of like a connoisseur of buckling asphalt. And so there's a question of like why this was allowed to be shown in Switzerland. In Switzerland has the image of kind of technological perfection, as you know. And why was even, why it got out at all. And my basic sense is that it's a kind of, it operates as a kind of diametric opposite to the other photograph, and was used for purposes of inoculation, essentially. That if you studied these early failures, you could sort of eradicate them and move forward, But, when I was there researching, and we'll see, I'll tell you why a little bit as we continue, I wanted to think about these two photographs as the kind of spectrum of possibility. Next one, please, Sina. This is the archive, the municipal archives in Zurich, where I did a lot of the work. You just often don't see the site of the knowledge production. It's sort of rendered invisible, And I think this is an important thing to bring before your eyes. Next. This is the Plots of Vansalis, where Rilke wrote much of the Duenio elegies and where I visited. And if you read the book, I'm not going to talk about this section, but there's a large passage on it. And that's all. Next one, please. That's my room that looked very much like that Goethe drawing, where Goethe is standing in the window and there's this great light behind it. It's my room inside. And I think it must have been Rilke's room, too. Next one, please. This is the one of the halls, and it looks like very much like one of the halls at Chadwick Manor, and it's inside the Plots of Vansalis. One more, please. See the next one. That's a view from down below. Okay, next one. And then you could actually, there are four of these, I believe. You can scroll through. This is a kind of typical hut typology, the Swiss Alpine hut. And part of the problem is something that I'm not going to touch on directly in the reading, but was to try to establish where several of these actually were. And there's a possibility that some of them had been rebuilt. And it became extraordinarily difficult to discern between old photographs of these and the new rebuildings because they're so, in a sense, generic. This is like a typical unit of Alpine architecture. Next one. And then there are just two more. This is the Albigna Dam. And this dam holds back a kind of frightening and hidden story of Swiss modernization that you will find out more about if you read the book. But not today. One more. That's all. Okay. So I'm going to trace one little path through the book, and that is the path of an architect that I didn't know about before I started doing this research, named Meir Ausenbildungs. And he is kind of experimental modernist. You'll find out about him and what follows. And for the first section, I don't think you actually need to know anything in advance. That's right. It begins with a quote from him. I discovered his manuscript, you'll find out, and actually in this chapter. Especially between 1890 and the current conflagration, World War I, a new culture, the engineering age, selected Switzerland as its laboratory, a mythical nation where the invention and testing of gravity-defying architecture could be pursued as a collective experiment in which sheer rock faces and vertiginous drops ceased to limit habitation and movement, where the entire country became a factory of engineered paths and suspended experiences, where the mundane pull of earthly mass ceased to exist. An architect raised in Holland who emigrated to Switzerland in the teens, Ausenbildungs was deeply moved by Swiss engineering, sensing an analogy to his own country. We know that Switzerland is an origin for Holland as the source of the Great Rhine, which, after passing through Germany, breaks down into the several effluvial basins that comprise the country of Holland. But Switzerland is also source of the Rhone River, and few would see any intimate tie between the Swiss and French national mythologies. Ausenbildungs proposed the landscape, and in particular, difficult-to-tame landscape, was at the center of the Swiss Dutch connection. According to him, Europe was carved up first by the largest, most powerful countries. France, Germany, England, Italy, and Spain got the most extensive and obviously habitable areas. Then there was some leftover region, especially the highest and lowest points. Switzerland got the mountains, Holland the swamps. Both, however, got mythologies of independence, economy, and self-sufficiency. This is Ausenbildungs. These myths derive not just from mundane human dramas, throwing off the yoke of by then feeble Spanish colonialism, or quietly sitting out the dance while Europe ravages itself in total war, but more from confrontation with the terrifying domain of the non-human. In his treatise, After Gravity, The Alpine War on Weight, the architect continues, surviving and even prospering in the face of cruel geographic nemeses which depend upon almost unbelievable technological breakthroughs, this allows great national stories and even habits of being to come into focus. Holland's all-pervasive water generates dikes, windmill pumping systems, canals and their trekvaarts, strong and efficient ships, and in general, the mechanical means to separate mud and rocks from seawater. Swiss mountains give birth to the multi-mile tunnels through solid rock, elegant and vertiginous bridges, precarious mountain train lines and trams, winding switchback mountain passes, and Alpine architecture with its sturdy, broad-roofed, blizzard-safe houses flanked vertically by terraced agriculture and anti-landslide shields. This latter engineering accomplishment then became the basis of Ausenbildungs' work as he went about articulating what he saw as Switzerland's unstated program of Alpine engineering-based modernism. This was manifested in After Gravity, the great manuscript that Ausenbildungs never published. I was glued to a facsimile of it in the Etihad Library. My coming into contact with it was, in fact, an accident. My plan had been to request photographs of Alpine architecture from Moret's period, and though this seems like a ridiculous shot in the dark, see if I could identify some actual ones taken by him, or at least learn something more about the context of his paid government commission from the 1890s. One was supposed to call ahead for reservations in the rare book library. I hadn't. Still, the receptionist was kind, and on hearing my request, summoned the director of special collections, who listened patiently to my account of the project. Yes, she would be happy to help, but she needed time to pull the images, so perhaps I could come back to Zurich after my research in the rest of the country. That seemed reasonable enough. And one last thing, was this for a book? Why, yes, at least if I found what I was looking for. Well, in that case, the cost of each reproduction would be 80 Swiss francs. The adolescent punk in me, guitarist in the band Squalor, did a 180 and headed for the door. He objected on principle to paying reproduction fees at all, especially for 100-year-old images. Luckily, though, the 42-year-old photography researcher and professor hadn't moved. He was slightly slower. In an attempt to make a polite exit, he suggested he'd send an email when he had the exact request worked out and asked if he could have a quick look around the reference room before he left. His spinelessness was grating. He was prepared to make a perfunctory stroll around the four freestanding stacks and wall-lining materials when the title, After Gravity, caught his eye. It was in a ring binder with a plastic cover. He began casually flipping, but after two sentences, I was engrossed. It wasn't until I'd read most of the book that I actually flipped through its credits and scanned the names of the photographers who helped. There was Moret, listed under the Canton of Graubünden. Skipping ahead for a minute. Awesome Buildings insisted time and again, and this is in the letters that I found in the same manuscript, that this or that building was not reproduced well enough, that a better, more dynamic view of this bridge could be had from an oblique angle farther down the ravine, that the force of this tunnel was actually best seen from a point on the opposite hillside. This kept not only the funders waiting, but also the army of photographers endlessly at work. The modernist master is unyielding perfectionist, driving his apprentices not just to new levels of precision and commitment, but to new forms of subjectivity. The binder did give a sense of this, but it also began to hint at something even stranger. And this is Awesome Buildings. The Swiss dream of defying gravity begins in simple rocks and logs suspended in a manner any child can manage, and ends with something wholly alien that we have not even begun to see. We have years of poor to middling photographs of engineering's results. But if we are to remain true to our project, the buildings and then the photographs themselves must invert the hypothalamuses in our souls, must render unspeakably terrifying and beatific even a glimpse of the printed page. This is why I send the fellows back repeatedly into the field, and this is why I know now, increasingly, that no book of photos will ever capture the anti-gravity dream we have here been at work on for the last 50 years. If the Dutch could see their functional country raised from the effluvium of the Rhine as proof of their triumph over these swamps, there was something in Awesome Buildings' meditation on Swiss architecture that withheld such an affirmation, as if the real proof of her accomplishment in the mountains was not as yet visible, but in fact still unapproachable because it would simply overwhelm an unprepared viewer. For the architect, this process was organized in Switzerland according to a ruthlessly consistent plot. This is him again. Weighty mass giving way to floating line. From these givens, its future can be extrapolated forever. Since the exterminating principles never cease to act, it follows that what is floating at one moment will be weighty at the next. Therefore, the performance can never end or even progress in the conventional sense of dramatic plotting. Can only be the cyclic restatement of a single theme, creation and destruction, irrevocably interlocked, endlessly reenacted. Such an understanding unsettled certain cherished cliches about the Swiss. According to Awesome Buildings, while the other European nations, having colonized the entire globe, were now going at one another, unleashing in their own backyards the most technologically sophisticated war machines ever made, it was a bovine myth to believe that Switzerland simply stood by idly basking in neutrality. In reality, the Swiss were anything but peaceful. For, as the architect phrased it, the country had announced a total war on gravity and was daily ridding mountainous terrain of gravity's traces, ruthlessly hunting down weight and mass and exterminating them. In two decades, having learned to despise banal valley architecture and the, as he put it, tuber-like consciousness produced by agriculture, post-gravitational Swiss subjects would jetpack 4,000 meters from their lower-level launching pads to the network of metal catwalks and cantilevered concrete housing pods that would soon dot the Alps' highest peaks. New sports would be invented for cliffs and sheer rock faces, as well as the apparatus to bring spectators face-to-face with this fast-paced, terrifying drama. It was this future of extreme alpine being that Ausenbildungs prophesied in his final manuscript, Sheer Genius, Being on the Edge. And I'll jump ahead. So I find out in the intervening chapters that Ausenbildungs actually built a couple things. He wasn't purely a paper architect. And in fact, he built something on the north wall of the Eiger, or at least a little fragment of something that didn't get completed. And this is the preliminary inquiry into that. It begins with a quote from Rilke's Duino Elegies. Then we, who think of rising happiness, would feel the emotion that almost confounds us when a happy thing falls. The end of Ausenbildungs' life remained a mystery to me. I knew that as he'd moved more toward the intensely polemical and visionary tone of Sheer Genius, he'd gradually lost interest in the documentation of the historic Swiss war with gravity that had been the subject of his first book. I'd known, too, that his collection of dramatic photographs of Swiss architecture, to which Moret had contributed, had never been turned over to the Swiss Bureau of Architecture. But this had seemed to me a classic genius fade-out. Alienated, alone, obsessed, Ausenbildungs had holed up in St. Moritz and vented his frustration in an almost incomprehensible screed about the future of weightless alpine living, his last book. There, the architect had become obsessed with the ice sled chute races at the famously fast and dangerous Cresta Run. What had struck me in the panoramic room at the Alpenhof, now I've gone to Appenzell, the other side of Switzerland, as I worked through the copies I'd made in the Swiss archives, was the grim story of Ausenbildungs' hands-on experiment in weightless architecture. The construction of a small housing settlement on the Eiger's Nordwand, or as it was popularly known, Mordwand, murder wall, since it was famous for fatal climbing accidents. The modular housing had been begun during the construction of the Jungfraubahn, an extremely steep railway line tunneling from Klein Schindeig in the Grunewald Valley through two stops on the Eiger to the Jungfrau House, the house above the clouds, which at 11,300 feet was the highest railway station in Europe. During construction, which had begun in 1896 and wasn't completed until 1924, Ausenbildungs won an anonymous competition to establish a series of suspended living modules accessible by the two stops on the north face of the Eiger, Eiger Nordwand and Esmir. After the tedious and unsuccessful struggle to force Ausenbildungs to complete and submit after gravity, Swiss government officials would certainly have run screaming from any proposal from the architect, had they known. And yet the shift in aesthetics that had gripped Ausenbildungs made the late style associated with Sheer Genius appear as that of an entirely different architect. And so it was he who won the blind competition. As enthusiastic about extreme alpine living as Ausenbildungs' new work seemed to be, there was nonetheless something off about his participation in the entire project. Reading the reports from his associates, I became engrossed in his intransigence. While the architect did his best to mask this as classic idealism, as tough rigor that routinely rejected competent results as uninspired, something else was involved. Not surprisingly, there was tension from the start between Ausenbildungs and the industrialist Adolf Geyer-Zeller, who had received a concession for the Rack Railway. He was the person who was building the railway system through. The construction of this line had already been slowed by several explosions, consequent strikes, and the unexpected discovery of a gypsum mine in the tunnel's path. But even after the first stops were completed, the housing modules bogged down the entire project. As long as the Eiger Nordwand and Eismer stops were devoted to the housing, new construction on the final leg of the Jungfraubahn would have to take a back seat. Unspeakably infuriated by Ausenbildungs' antics, Geyer-Zeller had pressured the Swiss government to cancel their commission. But this was not possible. As it turned out, though, both the government and the industrialist were soon relieved of their burden by a strange turn of fate. On October 16, 1919, Awesome Buildings made a visit to the construction site to check on the quality of a concrete shell into which he would later fit the steel and glass living modules. He had already rejected three previous pourings, and the workmen were getting antsy. One might call such a visit routine were it not that access to the site required full climbing gear. In any case, during the visit, a storm descended. With the modules only partly framed, the party had to return to the safety of the Izmir station. Like a ship captain, Awesome Buildings insisted on being the last to leave, accompanied only by a hired guide. As the snow mounted, the architect was only 50 feet above the Izmir station when he lost his footing, popped two safety rings, and, after the guide had rappelled to a position just beyond arm's length, popped the final ring and catapulted down the north face of the Eiger. Mittelholzer, who had been commissioned to capture the party surveying the construction with the new telephoto lens, the last surviving shot of Awesome Buildings, barely escaped as his plane just managed to skirt the edge of the storm. After Awesome Buildings' death, his living modules were tabled and the Jungfraubahn was soon completed. And then I'll just read the very last section, which is the only thing you need to know about this is that Jimbo and I work for a family called the Chadwicks, who can be kind of intrusive at times, and I had already met an assistant of theirs named Zoot, a kind of trendoid, annoying guy who had taken me up to see the piece of architecture, the kind of, it's like a basically like a Bond villain house on one of the Alpine peaks earlier in the story, and so Zoot reappears, and you just need to know who he is. Okay. Oh, and the other thing you need to know about this is that we decide that we need to investigate the actual footings that have been poured because we think there might be something about them that needs to be uncovered. So I propose this to Lex, my Swiss publisher, who's here with us. Lex was immediately game. Perhaps the request rekindled the not-so-distant memory of his extreme sports past. In any case, he called his friend Uli Steck, who held the record for the fastest solo ascent of the Eiger's north face, 2 hours and 47 minutes, set just 2 years ago in 2008. The two would be my guides. We stayed the previous night in Klein Schindeg, surveying the climb site from the telescopes on the terrace. Though it took a little persuading, I managed to convince the two that the point was merely to see the construction site, not to hike the entire mountain. And so therefore, we would take the railway to the Izmir station and climb from there. Steck knew a service door we could jimmy that would lead us out to the mountain. We waited for the other passengers to exit and quietly slipped along the track to the door. This was the scene of several previous rescue attempts where trapped climbers had called in for support. At the tunnel's edge, looking down the vertical rock wall, I felt my stomach tighten. Oh, previously in this book, I've been washed off two cliffs already, so there's a little bit of a history of that problem already. I did not want to relive what happened below the Albigna Dam. In a few minutes, though, we were hammered in and on our way. The morning was warm, excellent climbing weather. Partway up, we paused for water. I took up my field glasses and surveyed the scene. As I panned to the northeast, I thought I caught the glass panes of Thorndike's house. Thorndike is one of the Chadwicks. We visited him earlier. And tried to zoom in. Was that a figure at the telescope? I zoomed more closely and finally got it steady. There was the living room, and I could just barely make out the black tripod. The figure had vanished. Half an hour more, and the footings were coming into view. At first, nothing abnormal struck me about the construction site. The footings had been sunk in two huge parallel lines with a V in between. The only thing one noticed was the excessive amount of rebar used. I'd remembered Awesome Buildings harping on the necessity of double layers. As we approached, though, it became clear that the guidelines used to organize the two layers were not quite parallel. One seemed to have been rotated a few degrees off the other. Was this a simple mistake attributable to pouring concrete on a nearly vertical rock face? Or did it perhaps point to some idea about increasing traction by staggering the grids? Awesome Buildings had certainly not wanted gravity to win here, in this extreme site of his new weightless living, and so perhaps he'd gone to extreme technological lengths to secure the living pods. I myself was moving with extra caution. I hadn't expected to do so much climbing in Switzerland, and two near falls was enough. I was approaching a better viewing spot, stepping gingerly over the edge of an ice patch into powder when Lex exploded. "They're more aid. They're more aid. The rebars are rotated at 5 degrees. Look, the entire footing makes a huge M." I steadied myself and looked up at the two inverted Vs. It took a moment to register through my fogged goggles, but sure enough, each of the four legs had a shadow rebar pattern that intersected awkwardly. The result was like two chain-link fences seen through each other. It was a classic moiré, or rather, moiré with a capital M. No wonder Austin Buildings refused to put it in the glass and steel modules. They would have obliterated this effect. By degrees, I absorbed the strangeness of the monument. If this site was for Austin Buildings, the more extreme scene of technological challenge, the most extreme scene his architecture would ever confront, in which man tempted gravity both as climber and builder, then Austin Buildings would tattoo a permanent memorial against progress into the Eiger's north face. In monumentalizing Moiré as his predecessor, Austin Buildings positioned the photographer not as the author of an error, but as the inventor of a way to double back and thicken the otherwise almost invisible medium of the reproduced photographic image. It was a counter-nationalist Rushmore. In any case, the effect was definite. Even Uli, who had blown past this section of the mountain perhaps a half a dozen times, head to the stones now, and having the rebar pointed out to him, emitted the optical illusion of the interfering grids. A shotgun round echoed across the mountainside. I caught sight of a form prone on the first landing with direct sight lines to our position, just above the Eismir portal, firing above our heads at an enormous ice field. It was Zut, who was now scurrying back down the hill as the first chunks of ice began to pelt us. Descending was still for a moment an option, and so we followed Steck, who had pioneered a style of climbing anathema to the teachings of the classic Swiss alpinist, running. We had reached a crevice some 30 yards below us, and Steck motioned for us to halt and tuck ourselves flush against the mountain. As the avalanche picked up volume in a couple of seconds, it poured over our heads. Zut had now made it to the cusp of the mountain just above the tunnel opening, and was hiking his legs over the edge when he was struck by the ice, lost his footing, teetered on the edge for an instant, and then, emitting an unseemly, surprisingly high-pitched squeal, sailed earthwards, his shotgun cartwheeling off rocks before he hit himself some 1,500 feet below. Thank you. Oh, sure, I'll take questions, yeah. I mean, you know, it's very rare that the research I do winds up at this level of drama, but this, you know, I figured since this happened, I should try to record as much as possible of it.
I was wondering if you've heard from Steven Greenblatt at all since the publication.
I think you guys have never sent him the book.
Keeps
coming back to you.
No, we managed to get a book to him. We have a signature on a packet that shows that he did receive it.
What Sina's referring to is the fact that... Oh, really? You made him sign for it?
Yes, we made
That's
him
awesome.
Sign for it.
What Sina's referring to is that when I showed you the Palazzo Salus earlier, I ran into Steven Greenblatt there. There were like 8 people in the entire hotel, and he was one of them. And I knew him from graduate school. And
I wonder if everybody knows who Steven Greenblatt
so
is.
So Steven Greenblatt is a Renaissance... scholar of English literature and one of the pioneers of the new historicism. It's kind of slightly less positivist historical thinking that developed in the 1980s and was very much inspired by Foucault and on the one hand and say Clifford Geertz in anthropology on the other and was very interested in, and this is Steven Greenblatt's methodology in particular, this is what was so disturbing to find out. You know, he always, in his works, he always takes one minor kind of non-canonical text and says, this one tiny pamphlet from 1577 is the exact key to Henry IV. And you always wonder, like, well, how did he decide that this was the pamphlet? You know, because there are 8,000 of such pamphlets, you know. And what happened at the villa was that, Rilke had written about this great library and that the Von Salus family had, and at this early phase when Rilke was visiting in the teens, they didn't really open the whole place to everybody. It was just like to a few people, and Rilke was considered like okay to come in, you know. And So he wrote about this fantastic library that had nothing before the era of Napoleon and stretched back into the 15th century and was this amazing place. And when I was there, you know, I described this project to Greenblatt. He said, well, would you like to see the Rilke Library? And I was, you know, totally, I assumed that long ago it had been sold and, you know, and to pay the Venizelos' debts, and of course, you know, that they didn't have it anymore. But I was taken in there, and then this, you know, kind of frankly strange situation occurred where Greenblatt put down these visors over his eyes, and his wife said, okay, it's Henry IV, shoot the ball. And so he would shoot a ball, and depending on where the ball actually landed inside the archive, that would be the book he would have to connect to the particular Shakespeare play, you know? And so it's like this Oedipian procedure. I was like, oh, do you know about the Oedipo? And he didn't want to talk about that. It was all about the bard. And it was this very weird interaction. And so it's been a kind of a tense standoff when I've actually written about this. And we've had to send it to him to make sure he doesn't have a lawsuit and, you know, that kind of thing. So that's sort of why Sina is referring to that, I suppose.
No word,
yeah. Other questions?
So it's like a parody of new historicist, you know, aspirations or whatever? It seems like this the...
What Stephen was doing.
Well, I mean, this too, in the sense of the loving, obsessive, you know, working through huge amounts of archive in seemingly haphazard...
I hate specialists. You know, and I, at a certain point, I discovered that I knew more about Moray than anybody else in the world, and that made me feel terrible about myself. Because you know, those what specialists are like—the people who know more about anybody, one particular figure than it. I wanted to take it out on him, but I didn't. I mean, I think I wrote a pretty fair thing, but I struggled with that across the course of writing this book. If that answers your question. Stake your entire life on one person. You know what I mean? Not that we know of, yeah. Well, thank you.